Serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country. With 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our eye-opening conversation today with 94-year-old Francis Asbury of Albuquerque, New Mexico, originally from Tulsa, Oklahoma. His is a story that really underscores the heavy price that has been paid for the freedom the rest of us so easily take for granted. His only brother, Leon, a decorated fighter pilot, was killed in Italy toward the end of World War II. Francis, by any logical evaluation, had a very low probability of surviving what he faced after his Navy B-24 went down in flames into the Pacific Ocean in December 1944. Unable to brace for impact because he was delivering what proved to be a life-saving life jacket to his friend in the back of the plane, Asbury was knocked unconscious on impact, his facial structure shattered, his right arm useless and in severe pain because of a compound fracture. 8 of the 15 men aboard were killed, and he was one of the 7 who survived after he floated for 2 days in the Pacific Ocean, nearly 300 miles off of Hawaii. We've heard him explain all of that and how his parents finally learned he was alive because of a chance connection with a nurse who cared for him, who just happened to have gone to his high school in Tulsa. It's all pretty incredible, but it's not the end of the story. How long did it take you to recover from all those injuries?
Well, I was in the hospitals a year and a half.
A year and a half.
Yeah, but a lot of that was unnecessary because the doctor put steel plates in my arm and they didn't get the bones touching.
Ew.
And they have to touch in order to knit. So I ended up in Bethesda having 3 bone grafts and each one of them take a month to heal. So in between there and when we got back to the States, and my dad told me that my brother had been killed, then I went to the chaplain and the Red Cross and asked that I be sent to Norman, Oklahoma. Well, they sent me to Corpus Christi, Texas. And I was down there, I'm going to guess, probably a month. And I did the same thing. I went to the chaplain and Red Cross, told them my story. I said, I want to go to Norman, Oklahoma. And they made arrangements, and they sent me up there. But when I got there, there was no plastic surgeon. So I had to wait there for several weeks in order to be transferred to National Naval Medical Center in Bethesda, where they had plastic surgeons. So if you sit down and figure all that out, there's got to be 5 to 6 months in there where it really wasn't necessary because of situations.
I wonder, and I'm not trying to put words in your mouth or thoughts in your head, but I wonder if it was good that you had that time to process everything you'd been through and what happened to your brother. And maybe you can help explain what happened to your brother. I know you didn't find out for quite a while afterwards, but he's a P-47 pilot,
right?
Fighter pilot in Italy, where they did tons of bombing and strafing missions, flying every day, if not twice a day.
Yeah, he had 129 missions when he was killed.
He probably had some significant decorations, too, after all those missions.
He was decorated pretty good. And then, unfortunately, what happened was, at the end of 125, they could go home. And they asked for volunteers to do a few more flights. And he, unfortunately, volunteered. And if he quit at the end of his 125, then he would have been all right.
And by talking to guys who were in his fighter squadron, you were able to understand what happened to him that day? Explain that to us. What happened?
Well, they were out strafing, and they had some bombs on, and I don't know what they were bombing. But anyway, he had a bomb that hung up on his wingtip, and he also spotted this ammunition bomb, which he made a dive bomb on it, trying to shake the bomb off, and unfortunately, he shook it off. And he was down pretty low, and it exploded and knocked off his tail section. So he spun in. This was near Lake Garda in Italy.
Hmm. Is he buried there in Italy?
He was, and my mother raised so much cane with my dad, she wanted to bring him back to the States. So in 1950, we brought him back to the States. Buried him in Tulsa.
So that happened to him in February of 1945. But you didn't find out for a couple months after that.
I think I found out in April when I came back to the States from Hawaii.
What was that like to get that news?
Oh, that was probably the worst feeling I ever had in my life when my dad told me that, because we really were close. We were only 1 year. He was 21 months older than I was, but he was only 1 year ahead of me in school. And we did everything together. I was sort of the little brother, I guess. But that's the worst news that I have ever had in my life.
You know, and I often ask veterans to consider the odds or explain how they survive something. And you went through an unbelievable ordeal that the odds were against your survival. And you never would have married your wife. You wouldn't have had your three daughters. These grandkids wouldn't be here. And I'm sure you're thrilled about all of that, but I'm sure that's also tempered by what happened to your brother. Has that been hard to wrestle with over the years?
Oh, I've thought of him every day.
Every day.
Every day.
And I'm looking across. There's an open door here to your bedroom, and there is a big picture on the wall of an Army Air Corps officer.
That's him.
That's got to be Leon.
That's him.
Have you ever thought about what his life would have been like if he survived the war?
I've wondered, and you can't really wonder. I'm sure he would have been married and had a family, but what he would have done, I have no idea, but I sure wish I could have found out.
Yeah. And has that knowledge, has that awareness, has that sobriety, I guess, impacted the way you've tried to live your life for these 94 years?
I think only to the extent of taking care of my parents and trying to help them and whatnot, and that would be the key to it.
And I know you would have loved to have him, as you say, and to see what his life would have turned out. But when you think about that story you just shared of he could have come home after 125 and he volunteered to go back.
Right.
What does that say about the kind of man he was?
A good one. I think once you've been through that many missions, a few more didn't gonna make any difference. And you never think about it. Mm-hmm. You think, well, I'll just go do some more and then I'll leave next week. It's a situation where when your time's up, it's up.
Well, I'm really thankful that you shared some of his story with us. And that's when I run into stories like this, it reminds me, you know, on this program, we hear from veterans who survived the war, and there are 16 million Americans in the war. But it adds so much to our understanding when we also hear about some of those 406,000 who died in the war. Yeah. And your brother was part of that. And it sure seems, even after hearing that story, or especially after hearing that twist to it, that he embodied what President Lincoln said when he talked about giving your last full measure of devotion. I mean, I don't know how you could give more than what he gave.
Yeah, it's the ultimate sacrifice.
Amen. And you're not out of the woods. You've got this arm that they have a hard time fixing, a face that you need plastic surgery on, and they need to put the Legos back together up there.
Yeah.
So was that hard for you to deal with the shape you were in and that you're never going to be the same physically?
Yeah, I think it does to a certain extent, because my life would have been certainly different without all of the surgery that I had and whatnot. And as an example, I dated a girl in high school, and I saw her after I came back from the service and walking down the street, and she didn't even recognize me.
Your face was that disfigured.
It wasn't. It's different. It was swollen, and I had a patch on my eye.
Uh-huh. How long did it take to get the vision back in the other eye?
Well, the eyelid was closed, nerve damage.
Yeah.
And I didn't get it back open until I got up in Bethesda. So I had a patch on my eye for a year, and I had my arm in a cast for a year.
Wow. That's a long time.
And it's a long time.
Did you ever wonder, hey, am I ever going to see through this eye again?
I wondered about that, yes.
Yeah.
Because once they got it open, I had what you might refer to as double vision. If I look straight ahead at you, I see one of you. But if I move my head a little bit, now I see two.
Hmm.
It's a shadow.
Uh-huh.
It's not two distinct pictures of your head, but it's a shadow over
right
here. But as long as that's been a big problem. My mouth has been a big problem. Outside of that, I got along fine.
What's the challenge with your mouth? All the teeth you lost?
Yeah, the eating. It's a little hard.
For 70 years, it's been hard. So,
pretty much.
Wow.
Because the lower jaw, part of it was shattered off, and then the upper jaw has what they call a fibrous reunion. It's like sticking gum up.
Yeah.
So it's been a problem, yeah, ever since.
But you're one of the most cheerful and outgoing guys around Paloma Landing here. How does that add up?
I don't know.
You decided not to let it bother you, not to let it get to you?
I never felt sorry for myself. I went to the VA once at Muskogee. There was one eye doctor there that said he could correct this vision. He passed one eye and went home for a week. Went back, he passed the other eye, went home for a week. And over a three-week period, I went back and he gave me a pair of glasses. And I put them on and everything was double. And I got back and Phyllis asked me, she says, "How's the eye doing?" I said, "Honey, I'll show you." And I picked them out of my pocket and dropped them in the wastebasket. I never went back to the VA for 55 years.
Wow. And you mentioned her name. Maybe it's a good thing that other girl didn't recognize you, because would you have ended up with Phyllis that way?
Well, Phyllis was the one who didn't recognize me.
Oh, she was?
Yeah.
Well, you got to fill in the blanks then. How'd you convince her that you were you and you were worth getting serious with?
Well, I yelled at her. I says, "Hey, this is Asbury."
So you two had known each other before the war?
Yeah. She was at the university a year ahead of me.
And you never went back overseas after all this, right?
Oh, no.
Yeah, you weren't in any kind of shape to do that.
No.
But the GI Bill allows you to go to the University of Tulsa.
Mm-hmm.
And you ended up with a long career with Shell Oil Company. And how'd you convince Phyllis to marry you?
Good question. When she was in college and the war started, she quit and went to work. And she said there wasn't any reason to be in school because all the guys were in the service. So, anyway, we just kind of hooked up afterwards. And it was just, I guess I was the only one left, so she took me.
Well, I wish I could get her side of the story. I want to ask you about an adventure you had here in the last year when you got to go up in an old Stearman two-seater and feel that wind in your face with ageless aviation dreams. But when you think back about the time in the Navy, what you did, what you went through, is there something that you look back on and say, you know, I'm really proud of that, or I'm really thankful for this?
Well, I guess the main thing is to be thankful that we got picked up, because I never thought we would. It was a long road to hoe to get back to pretty much to normal, and never back to normal. But I don't dwell on the past. It's just like Phyllis and I were married 61 years. It was 61 very, very good years. So you can't dwell on that. I just had a good life.
What keeps you going now at 94?
Oh, physically, I'm in good shape. My only problem right now is breathing, and I have a terrible time breathing. If I could breathe, I'd be out on the golf course.
Would you shoot your age?
I doubt it.
You're still an honest man. I appreciate that. You know, another thing popped into my head. I'm just imagining what it must have been like for your daughters growing up around you, knowing what you'd been through. Did you ever use your story to hold them accountable? Like if they were complaining about something, or they thought they had it rough, or they were feeling sorry for themselves, did you ever mention what you'd been through out there in the ocean?
Never.
Never.
Never. I made a little write-up after 2000. Somebody said you ought to write up something for your kids. I did. They're, I think, like a lot of other kids, they weren't around during the war, so I don't know. It's kind of something that doesn't mean a lot to them.
Hmm.
They know that I went down, and they know that we were picked up and whatnot. They know that I was in the hospital a long time. But they've never really asked questions, and most people don't. It's a funny thing. You can come in here and meet somebody, new person, and you're curious about them, and you ask them if they were may have been in the service or what they did or where they're from and all that stuff, and they'll tell you, and they get a conversation going, but they never ask you. It's a rare situation when somebody turns around and asks you what you did.
And when they do, you watch for their jaw to drop when you tell them what happened to you, right?
I don't tell them very much.
Well, I'm glad that you've been willing to share with us today. It's an incredible story of survival, and it really does remind us of how thin that thread can be and what a debt of gratitude we owe to people like you and your brother who have paid that price for our freedom. In light of that, is there something that if your daughters or your grandkids said, what's the most important thing we need to know about World War II and what you guys did and why you did it? How would you answer that?
I guess the most important thing would be to know that we did go down and we were lucky enough to get picked up. And that's nothing but luck.
And I've got to ask you about this Stearman. So Ageless Aviation Dreams, they go all around the country. They make stops in different cities. And they take people around your age and even older up to get a taste of flying. And you used to fly in this big old bomber with 10 other guys, but here you're up in the front seat with a pilot behind you and the wind in your face. What was that like for you?
It was fun. I hadn't been up in an open plane in many, many years. It was good to get up. The people were fantastic treating us. They did a super job. The other guys that went up, one of them had no legs. He lost his legs, I think, because of a blood disease, but he was in Korea. They got him in that plane, believe it or not. I couldn't believe it. But they got him up and got him out of that plane. And it's not easy to get in and out of, really.
No.
It was a lot different than I thought it was going to be, but it was a lot of fun.
And a little different view than the top turret of a B-24?
Yeah, because I could see the ground.
You like it better that way?
Oh, yeah.
I know I'm bouncing around, but I thought of something else. You mentioned when you were talking about December 19th of 44 and what happened to you, you mentioned the pilot who spotted you and that you had a chance later to go find him.
Well, what happened was the co-pilot lived back east, and he was able to find him, and he went over to his house. They took a picture of both of them together, so I know what he looked like. And then I had talked to him on the phone several times. We started corresponding with Christmas cards. But anyway, he finally moved to Coronado, and I heard from him for a couple of years after he moved out there, and I presumed that he probably died because I hadn't heard from him.
Of those seven guys who survived your crash, how many are still alive now?
None that I know of.
You're the only one?
I think so. I know the pilot, the co-pilot, and my good buddy Vandergriff. I know they're all gone. I know Stevenson, the plane captain, is gone. So that's four. My guess is I'm the only one.
Well, that just adds to my gratitude for your sharing that story with us today, since you're the only one that can tell it. And I want to make sure that I tell you thank you for serving our country, for telling us your story. Yeah. Is there anything else you think we need to know?
No, you're certainly welcome, and I appreciate the conversation.
Well, I know I'm not the only one listening who appreciates you and what you've been through. That is Asbury. If he doesn't need a first name in Albuquerque, he doesn't need one here either. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com for photos of him and for more information on Ageless Aviation Dreams, that nonprofit group that, counting Mr. Asbury, has now provided those dream flights in a Stearman biplane to nearly 2,300 people in 37 states. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.